administration, the second order for the matter of good administration is called Kshatriya. Chat means hurt. One who gives protection from harm is called Kshatriya, Trayate, to give protection. The Kshatriyas are trained for killing in the forest. A Kshatriya would go into the forest and challenge a tiger face to face and fight with the tiger with his sword. When the tiger was killed, it would be offered the royal order of cremation. This system has been followed even up to the present day by the Kshatriya kings of Jaipur state. The Kshatriyas are specially trained for challenging and killing because religious violence is sometimes a necessary factor. Therefore, Kshatriyas are never meant for accepting directly the order of sannyas or renunciation. Nonviolence in politics may be a diplomacy, but it is never a factor or principle. In the religious law books it is stated, Ahaveshu mito nyanyam jigam sato mahikshita yudhamana param satya svargam yant yaparan mukha yagyeshu pashavo brahman hanyante satatam dvijay samskrita kilamantraishcha tepi svargam avapnuvan. In the battlefield, a king or kshatriya, while fighting another king envious of him, is eligible for achieving the heavenly planets after death, as the Brahmins also attain the heavenly planets by sacrificing animals in the sacrificial fire. Therefore, killing on the battlefield on religious principles and killing animals in the sacrificial fire are not at all considered to be acts of violence, because everyone is benefited by the religious principles involved. The animal sacrificed gets a human life immediately without undergoing the gradual evolutionary process from one form to another. And the Kshatriyas killed on the battlefield also attain the heavenly planets, as do the Brahmins, who attain them by offering sacrifices. There are two kinds of swadharmas, specific duties. As long as one is not liberated, one has to perform the duties of his particular body in accordance with the principles of religion in order to achieve liberation. When one is liberated, one's svadharma, specific duty, becomes spiritual and is not in the material bodily concept. In the bodily conception of life, there are specific duties for the Brahmins and Kshatriyas respectively, and such duties are unavoidable. Svadharma is ordained by the Lord, and this will be clarified in the fourth chapter. On the bodily plane, svadharma is called varnashram dharma, or man's stepping stone for spiritual understanding. Human civilization begins from the stage of varnashram dharma, or specific duties in terms of the specific modes of nature of the body attained. Discharging one's specific duty in any field of action in accordance with the orders of higher authorities serves to elevate one to a higher status of life. Omagyana timirandhasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun malitamyena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So, the Bhagavad Gita begins with the word dharma. Dharma is an interesting concept. Actually, it is a whole collection of concepts that are proposed by the word dharma. And it says, dharma kshetri, kshetri, kuru kshetri. Those are the first words of the Bhagavad Gita. So the word dharma is very important. And so in this particular verse, the word svadharma is the beginning of this verse. And sva means of yourself or of the person involved. So the particular svadharma, it means the particular dharma that is allocated to a specific person because of his status in life, because of the material considerations of his life. Each and every one of us in this material world, there are certain factors that we cannot overcome. Or we cannot overcome, at least in very, very extreme circumstances, the fact that we are either male or female. We cannot overcome what parents we have, whether we are aristocrats or whether we are from the lowest form or whatever. There are certain things that you cannot overcome. And this in a sense, determines your dharma, your particular dharma in your particular body in this particular life. So the problem, as we understand it, is that people in general in the West do not understand where their dharma is coming from, where their svadharma is coming from, and where the overriding principles of dharma are coming from, because this is not philosophically examined by their secular or by their religious doctrines. It is only when one approaches the Eastern religions that you actually start to get into this philosophical understanding of who we are as people, what we are doing here, why we are here, and how this whole material energy has come to be. We can understand it is universal in all religions that God is the creator of this world. How God creates, of course, is a whole subject. Every religion tries to examine the fact of origin. Where is this material world coming from? And so ultimately, where are we as people coming from? And so this is a major, you could say, philosophy in all religions, that there is a creator who is above and beyond, who is transcendental to this material realm. That's the basis of all religion. However, in the Bhagavad Gita, we understand so many things that arise from these material dilemmas that we have. If we look at components, there are actually two things. It's kind of, they rhyme. There's dharma and karma, which is kind of neat. It's neat that they should rhyme, actually, because dharma is the basis of who we are and how we are supposed to behave, and karma is what we actually do, what actually happens, and how the hows and the whys of how it happens to us. So these are the critical facts that are outlined in the Bhagavad Gita. It is the most important, the dharma and the karma, because it starts off, and in the famous verse where Arjuna says, "Now I'm confused about my duty," again he uses the same word dharma. "Now I'm confused about my dharma, and therefore I'm not going to fight, because there's no, I don't see the result. I don't see where this is going to bring me in the ultimate sense. And therefore, I'm," in one sense, he was looking for a way out of his dilemma. And he thought that by renunciation, and that's also an interesting concept, finally, the 18th chapter is called the perfection of renunciation. So that is the final thing that Arjuna has to learn in this saga of the Bhagavad Gita, is how to is what the perfection of the renunciation. Because actually, to jump to the end of the story first, at the end, Krishna says to him, "You have to sarva dharman parityaja. You actually have to give up whatever, all these concepts of dharma that you have, all this idea of fighting for honor or fighting for sense enjoyment, fighting to conquer the world, and you have to simply surrender to Krishna. That is your ultimate goal of life." And it's interesting that it should be posed in this way, or presented in this way, that you have to relinquish your whole sense of duty, your whole sense of dharma, to this higher cause. And of course, the thing is that such a thing cannot be done out of ignorance. Such a thing has to be done from a platform of knowledge, from a platform of understanding who we are. And so therefore the Bhagavad Gita begins and explains, and in fact, Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, while you're speaking all these learned words, your philosophical reasons for relinquishing your duty, and he mentions one, Kula Dharma. Kula Dharma, Kula means the place, or your birthplace, your ancestral place, this Kula Dharma, and it's translated roughly in English as family traditions. So families come from a specific place, place and time, and that is the concept of Kula Dharma. And so Arjuna explains that if I kill all these people, then because all the family traditions, all the underpinning of society will be lost because of this fantastic catastrophe that is going to take place. Therefore, it's better that I don't fight. And so that is one. And then here, as is mentioned in this verse, Varnashram Dharma is the, as we understand, the four Varnas and the four ashrams, which outline the Vedic concept of society. It is basically what it is a division of labor. Without a division of labor, you cannot have civilization. You cannot have material advancement, and a material advancement that allows people to live in a civilized way and not simply dog-eat-dog society, you know, unless you have a division of labor. And the Vedic prescription is that one should understand the various categories of labor, and that these categories are determined by people's natures. Again, that is the concept of Svadharma comes in again, that people have to understand who they are, and who they are materially will lead to understanding who they are spiritually also, if they acquaint themselves with spiritual knowledge. So it is the most important aspect of the Krishna consciousness movement is to spread this understanding and knowledge of who and what we are and why we're here. And as I mentioned before, in general, Western society has what I would call an intellectual blind spot when it comes to the concepts of karma and reincarnation, because these are the most important aspects of material life, that according to a particular karma, one has to take birth again in this material world. And according to the amount of piety one performs, pious acts, whether these acts can be acts of charity, they can be acts of sacrifice, and so on. And in general, if you look at each facet of life, if you look at the four varnas, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, the Shudras, each one has a certain activity that they have to perform, and they also have certain responsibilities that they have to take up. In other words, they enjoy a certain lifestyle, but then on the other hand, they have to perform a certain sacrifice, certain austerities, in order to maintain that lifestyle, and in this way make advancement. And there's so many verses on Dharma, for example, in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the second chapter describe the various things of Dharma, but the ultimate verse on that is that no matter how well someone may perform their specific occupational duties in the Varna Ashram system, if they don't attain Krishna consciousness, if these activities are not directed towards Krishna, is described that Shrama Eva Hi Kevalam, that these things are simply a waste of time, that you're given a certain human birth in order to actually come to the platform of spiritual understanding. And if your activities, however beneficial they may be materially, however dutiful they may be, if they do not lead you to an understanding or at least lead you to a desire to have an understanding of spiritual life, then they're a waste of time. So it's just like you can see in the modern world, there's an example I love to give. There's a man by the name of Ted Turner, and he's a very wealthy man, and he's what we would term a Vaishya of sorts, in that he made his money in business. And so it's one of the duties of the Vaishyas is to give in charity. And somehow instinctively he knew this. He knew this as a man of great wealth. And so he decided he would be the first man to donate $1 billion to charity. And he chose the United Nations Children's Fund. And he was going to give $100 million a year to this charity. So this, at least he had some understanding of what is that charity. But the question then we would ask is this: this is a wonderful charitable act, you know, and it's done for a good cause, that feeding children who are in need and distress, that is a wonderful cause. But will it lead him actually to spiritual life? Does he see the transcendental benefit? Does he see any transcendental benefit from that? And, well, the jury is out. Only he and Krishna know for sure. But still, the example is there, and it's a very striking example, that unless we understand that in his future life, he will actually attain whatever that donation brings in human advancement or in material advancement, he will get the benefit of that in his next life. And charity is not not to be considered grossly material, something by devotees as something material that we don't. We just had an example of charity here just a few minutes ago. Charity for a specific transcendental benefit, but there are also stories. There's one particular story in Mahabharata, how Yudhishthira, I think it was. I'm not 100% sure on, because I heard this secondhand. So, anyway, he came upon this demigod, effulgent demigod, and this demigod was at a graveyard. And this demigod was eating a body in the graveyard, right? So Yudhishthira wanted to know. He inquired, "How come? You know, that you're an effulgent personality. You're obviously from the heavenly planets. You're obviously a very brilliant person. Why are you engaged in this gross activity?" And so the demigod explained. He said, "Well, actually, in my previous life, I was a great sage. I was a transcendentalist. I was meditate, and I attained the effulgent form that you see due to my great austerities and penances. But I had one fault. I never gave in charity. And because I never gave in charity, the only thing that I have that I did give in charity to was my own body. I had to feed myself. And so therefore, all I have to eat in this life is my dead body." You know, this is one of the heaviest stories I've ever heard from the Puranas and the histories. So charity is important, as are austerities, as are sacrifice, in one form or another. So, but we as devotees, we understand that there, above and beyond these material things, there's a wonderful chapter in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's the conversation between Lord Chaitanya and Ramananda Roy in the Madhya Lila chapter 8. And Lord Chaitanya asks Ramananda Roy, "Please enlighten me as to the ultimate goal of life. What is the ultimate goal of life? And Ramananda Roy begins by saying that if one follows Varnashram Dharma, that in order to please Lord Vishnu, one has to perform his duties according to the rules and regulations of Varnashram Dharma. And Lord Chaitanya's reply was, this is external. Please, you have to elaborate more. And at each stage, Ramananda Roy explains that Lord Chaitanya asks these questions. Ramananda Roy goes to the next level. And the next level after that is whatever one performs, whatever benefit one gets, one should renounce the fruits of his action. And Lord Chaitanya again says to him that this is also external. You have to go further. And so the first step that Ramananda Roy explains is what we consider to be sadhana bhakti. And Lord Chaitanya says, yes, this is all right, but you have to go further. And so Ramananda Roy, he expounds the entire, gradually as the questions become more and more depth, Ramananda Roy goes in more and more depth as to the spiritual reality up until the point of the relationship and the intimate pastimes of Radha and Krishna. It's a wonderful chapter. If you haven't read it in a while, I do recommend. It's something that just grabs your attention and focuses it in a way that's very enlightening and very uplifting. So this is some of the realizations on Dharma and Karma. And I wonder if anyone has any questions at this point. Or yes. Yes. The heavenly planets. Yes.
And the others are not fighting on religious principles, they're just fighting out of greed. So how is it that somebody who's not fighting on the basis of religious principles attains the heavenly planets? Or is the religious principle simply to fight for Kshatriya, even if it's not for the right reason?
The religious principle is to fight. You could use the example of Bhishma as one of the problem Kshatriyas. Because we understand Bhishma is like a Mahajan, you know, he's one of the great knowers of religion, one of the propounders of Dharma, in fact. And there's a huge part of the Mahabharata is Bhishmadev's passing away, and it's also in Srimad Bhagavatam. They all come and they all hear the exposition of religious principles as outlined by Bhishmadev, but we know Bhishmadev was on the wrong side. Why was he on the wrong side? You know, it's a paradox that such an advanced and spiritual personality, but he had charge of the Kuru dynasty. He was, because Dhritarashtra was blind, and Bhishma could not be the king, in fact, because of his vow. So there's a whole argument to be made that actually, if Bhishma had not followed Vedic principles and given up his vow and become the king, he would have actually saved the whole dynasty. He would have saved, you know, he would have been able to adjudicate and make the proper arrangement. But that wasn't Krishna's arrangement, in a sense. So how Bhishmadev comes to be on the other, on the wrong side, is really the question that you're asking. And he comes to be on the wrong side because of his because he has what do you call it? He's getting his sustenance, as they say. He's being supported by Duryodhana. He's being supported by the Kurus, and therefore he has an obligation. He has a Kshatriya's obligation. So it's a very, you know, I mean, difficult to reconcile that such an advanced personality should be on the wrong side. Is that, I don't know that that's exactly answers the question, but.
Kind of, yeah. I guess I'm just wondering why both sides would get the same reward ultimately. If, you know, if the purpose of Kshatriya, you know, you have to look at the sort of principle. Like, for instance, somebody asked Prabhupada, I think, I don't know, about Vikings or whatever, you know, and he said, they're not Kshatriyas, they're murderers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sure. One could say that, you know, that from the karmic point of view, that the two families had a tremendously intertwined karma. You know, they were attracted to each other and they were repelled by each other, and so this is the material. This is how material life plays out. People are attracted and repelled. The senses are there. And so in the same way, and sometimes the impersonalists, they use metaphors like this, that the Pandavas represent the five senses, and, you know, this is how they come to that kind of speculation. But you could say that because of their relationship to the Pandavas, whether it was just like Kamsa's relationship with Krishna also, he was meditating on Krishna all the time. And they were meditating on the Pandavas all the time, how to kill these guys, because they are preventing us from being the emperors of the world. And so that meditation, you can say, gave them the punya, the karmic credit, you could say, to be able to, on the battlefield, be facing Arjuna, and as being killed by Arjuna, they would see Krishna in front of them when they were being killed, and therefore they would attain liberation from that platform. So in the Mahabharata situation, it's kind of relatively easier, but as you say, in the Viking situation, it's just a question, these people are murderers and plunderers and you know, demons of one kind or another, kind of a Kali Yuga mix of, you know, of humanity at large. I don't know how to say it. You know, a Kali Yuga, it's the people that are born in Kali Yuga and are kind of regarded as the bottom of the barrel. You know, that's why we're here. It's like unfortunate, but there's not too many there are not too many Mother Teresa's in and yes, so.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
I missed your discourse by the way, so I apologize. It may not have any relevance to this. Each of us as teachers have to come from a background of maybe Western religion or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you just made a statement that in our time, Kali Yuga is the bottom of the barrel.
So Christianity has that. Actually, it reminds me of a bumper sticker I once saw. It says, "Where am I going and why am I in this handbasket?" To be serious about the question, yes, we understand that there are hellish planets, there are hellish sufferings that people have to go through, and sometimes you see these hellish sufferings played out. You know, in the Spanish Inquisition, the rack, all kinds of, waterboarding, to bring it up to date, all these kinds of things that are there, that are manifestations of hell on earth. And basically the law of karma is this, is that there are two aspects of it. There's a physical aspect to the law of karma, action and reaction. That's in purely physical terms. But in subtle terms, the law of karma is that whatever benefit or whatever enjoyment people enjoy as a result of your actions, you get to enjoy in your next life. And whatever sufferings you cause to other living entities, you will have to suffer in your next life. That is the basic understanding of karma as we understand it in Krishna consciousness. Now, whether this takes place in an elevated state, like the demigod that I was describing, who had to eat his body, because of his lack of charity in his previous life, or whether it's in the hellish planets, there are actually hellish planets, like the one that is ruled over by Bali Maharaj, where people have a high standard of sense gratification. They have no spiritual qualities. They have no chance to attain spiritual qualities that much, but they have a high enjoyment factor in that planet. So our argument or our proposition to people is Abrahma Bhuvana Loka, that from the highest planet down to the lowest, all of them are places of misery because birth and death exist there. And there's no escaping death. And therefore, the true benefit is to find a way out. And it is only transcendental life that gives you the way out. So that's our answer to the heaven and hell situation. Basically, the Western religions are: if you lead a good life, you go to heaven; if you lead a bad life, you go to hell. And there's not much philosophy in the Christian or Jewish or Islamic faiths that deal directly with the actual position of the living entity. They've derived most of their philosophy from Aristotle and the Greeks, really. And the Greeks were, pretty third rate when you compare it to philosophical systems of India, and even Buddhism is kind of better. Bottom, yeah.
You're still suffering.
Right.
And I think that's
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, it really doesn't exist. You know, just plow yourself with materialism and there will be no stuff.
Well, sometimes I think it's also an East Coast, West Coast thing. See? If you're on the West Coast and you tell people, hey, you're suffering, you go down to Venice Beach, you tell people you're suffering, come on, I'm not suffering. It's sunny, the surf is up, you know, we're having a great time, you know. But if you go into New York and you tell people, oh, people are suffering, they, yeah, for sure, man, you know, kind of thing. So that's the kind of the, you know, highest to the lowest kind of situation. Yes, Prabhu. Correct. Thank you, sir. Yes. And to, well, conclude with the famous shloka, Kaler Dosha Nide Rajan. And that this age of Kali is an ocean of faults. But there is one factor that Kirtanad Eva Krishnasya Mukta Sangha Param Vrajit, that the chanting of the holy name, Kirtanad Eva Sangasya, chanting of the holy name in communion with others, that this is the path of liberation. So that is the one easy prescription that is given to the unfortunate inhabitants of this particular age, is that this is the way out, the solution. And it is a very simple solution also, that chanting of the holy name. And so I'd like to thank you very much for your questions. Hare Krishna. Thank you.